This episode of the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast has been brought to you by our sponsors at Sweet Cheetah Publicity. Sweet Cheetah is a PR collective that values people over profit. They put a different spin on public relations by working primarily with friends and using all profits to aid charitable organizations. With a roster that includes Jawbox, The New Amsterdams, Briniac, Get Some, Funeral Date, Damian Dunn, and many more artists, record labels, and podcasts. Sweet Cheetah, that's a great PR cohort. You can find them on social media by simply searching Sweet Cheetah PR, and they'll be there. He's been Tim. I've been Peter. And Sweet Cheetah has been beautiful.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you, gentlemen?
Good.
Good.
I'm going to start off and make a sweeping statement. Okay. You guys know I'm a fan, and going back quite a ways, this is the best fucking record of your career.
Thank you, man.
Best thing you've ever done. There's a couple reasons for that.
Tim's.
There's 10 reasons for
that. No, I said Tim.
Tim's a part of it too. But you know, I think the big part of it really is the fact that even though you disagreed with me when I interviewed you for Off Shelf, that it was like the most embattled record of your career, I know you guys had a lot of problems kind of like getting this out to the world. I don't know how to quantify that for the listening audience, nor do I think we should really have to, because it's none of their damn business. But you know, in this day and age, it's so fucking difficult to cut through and get something produced in a physical manner. You know, it's an uphill battle for any musician, whether you have a label behind you or not, but to get anybody to commit to putting something out there into the world that's tactile, that you can have a physical relationship with, is so difficult. And this one, I think, is not only your darkest, probably musically darkest record, but also your most, I think, sonically varied, because the whole thing kind of takes a journey. I think not only lyrically, but sonically. If you could kind of give us an idea of what the through line for the whole record was.
As far as getting it released, or as far as like the musical,
the music and lyrical roller coaster.
You know, it's funny. I think we might have said this when we were on with you before. Is we record like a lot. Like we've been recording since, I guess 2019. Like a lot. Me and Ben are always like swapping files, and we come down here and building music, and then Walt will come in and add his parts, and we all kind of. You know, there's probably 70 songs that we haven't released that are like kind of on a drive that we save. And this one, I think, usually what we would do is we'd when Jason was in the band, I'd say, okay, I think these songs are pretty good. What do you think for a record? Like I'd pick these songs that had a relationship to one another. And then I'd send it to these guys and they'd say, okay, this is cool, or that's not good, or maybe we could try this song in its place. And then Jason's job was always to organize the flow of the record. He always wanted to do that. I was like, oh, that's cool. You know what I mean? Because that's difficult. You got to listen to a bunch, bother a bunch of friends and say, what do you think of this? Like, does this flow? Especially my wife, she just drives her nuts. She's just like, what do you think of this order? She goes, just let me listen. Stop. Just, you know. This record, however, I feel like all the songs were done in mostly, except for Enemy Mine, in the same period. So basically, it's the closest thing that we've done to a record that was recorded in a set of amount of time, like over the last year mostly. And then there was another opening song that we ended up switching with Tilt, because Tilt was going to be on an EP, an idea, and I'm like, this would be really good to open the record. And then everybody was like, yeah, that's cool. So would you agree? I think it's mostly like a certain period of time. It's like I said, except for Enemy Mine was written back when Lifeboat Candidate came out. So aside from that,
I mean, it's sort of a snapshot of a whole like kind of recording burst, I guess. So, I mean, yeah, the sonically, if they fit together, that's just because they're in close relation to one another. Like, we didn't go back and pick too many old ones to fit on with the new ones. It was just kind of the top of the order of what we wrote.
One of these days, we're going to say, let's write a record, and it's going to be like top to bottom. This is going to be it, and it's going to be in. But we haven't done that yet. You know, this is probably the closest thing to that. Yeah, we thought we listened to them all over and over again. We swapped songs out around the same period, and then we came up with these, and we felt like it was a pretty good arc to the record. I'm happiest with it. I think it's my favorite one we've done, personally. I don't know if the lyrics have any tie-ins like Lifeboat Candidate did. I don't know. They're kind of
all over the place, I guess, but same kind of thing, like. Whatever was on my mind at the all in that period of time, but
yeah.
But to me, in my opinion, there's a even though there may not be like a cohesive through line to it, I think there's something that kind of ties all of these songs together spiritually in a way, because as you kind of take this journey, there's something almost cinematic about this record's journey. I don't think it's necessarily dark in a gothic way or a post-punk way, but dark in like a crisis of the human spirit kind of way, almost, because
all the stuff that Ben writes.
Yeah, I'm always in a crisis of the human spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's kind of cool though, that the whole idea is to put the music out there. And, you know, some of this stuff is subconscious, and then it allows, you know, you to have a viewpoint on it and how it relates to your life, and then other people the same. And that's why we don't like to give too much information about, like, maybe this song is about this thing. It's like, it just kind of flows with, it should go to you, and you should figure out what it means.
I also watched the 24-hour Dateline channel, so... If things get a little dark, I apologize. It's just, you know, it's what you put in, you get out. You know?
So I hate to see what's going to come out of this era specifically, since we are witnessing genocide at the current moment. Like, my yes. God, I can only imagine what records are going to sound like in a year from now.
Yeah.
How do you kind of square that circle, though? Like, we're constantly in this state of flux where we're waiting for the next tragedy to occur. And unfortunately... that next tragedy always does seem to occur.
I feel like we're addicted to it at this point. The news is addicted to it. It's all you get fed all the time, everything.
But do you remember a time, like maybe on YouTube, but certainly not Instagram, where we're seeing mortality play out in a Grand Guignol fashion constantly, like just bloodshed and human suffering is de rigueur on Instagram, on Facebook, where these images are just constant barrage to the point where we almost become numb to it. To me, it seems that we're going to reach kind of like an apex moment where we're all going to just turn off and become callous. For yourselves, what keeps you, especially watching Dateline and things like that, what keeps you still empathetic and in touch with the human condition?
Writing music. I mean, I feel like that's the way you exercise it. I mean, I have a history of anxiety. I've talked about it before. And like, I think we all have a history of anxiety at this point, but for a point in my life, it was clinical. And it's like, you know, the thing that got me out of it was music, was to like, it's kind of a meditation. Meditation also is wonderful, but I just don't have that, what do you call it? The monkey on the treadmill. So it's hard for me. I'm always thinking of a million things. It's hard to control it.
Yeah.
So with music, it's easier for me to focus on a thing at a time. It's like focusing on a frequency or focusing on an edit or focusing on like the you know, what songs I'm working on that day. That's why I do it every day. That's why Ben does the same thing. And that's why we have so much stuff, is because we both, I think, use it to get out of the horror of like just existing, just going and looking on the television. Also, I try to limit, you know, television, X was really, really bumming me out big time. So I went over to Threads, and right now my Threads feed is wonderful. It's a bunch of musicians talking about music. So I'm not seeing politics over there. And if it is, I don't follow it. I don't give it any time so that the algorithm picks up that I'm interested in it. So you know, if I get away from all of that and I stick with that, it makes me a little bit more stable. And you know, I always try to find a point in the day for an hour or two to get out into nature and walk around a little bit, put on my, but usually I'm listening to news podcasts. I think I talked about that, which is also a bummer, but also music.
He's in a beautiful setting listening to horrible things.
Basically, I escape. Basically, my escape is to just turn it off and just work on music. Or when we tour, it's great because then you're just in this little bubble and you're just going from place to place, and all you're worried about is that show that night and getting there in one piece and what hotel you're going to be in. That's great in a way. It's just like, and then you just meet music fans and other musicians. Yeah, that's how I escape from it. I mean, personally, I don't give myself enough time to just sit there and spend much time with the horror. But I don't also want to become numb to it. Like you said, like, I don't want to look at like murder and bloodshed and think like, it's what it is. You can't, if you do that, your humanity is gone.
And cool. I think we're living in that generation now, though, like, where I think people older than us, honestly, because we're still of a time period where we were dreaming of what Gen X has become, like these people who are accepting and very inclusive. Our generation, we're Gen X. We are the dreamers that brought that dream into being almost. The people before us who are still like tenuously hanging on to life by a very thin thread and still keeping control of our government, like, they're the ones that are still the bloodthirsty and the ones that are feeding that cycle. But sadly, we're still reaping all of it and weathering it. Mm. I think once they're gone, I really believe this. Once they're gone, and these Gen Z kids take over, the world's going to be in a much better place. I hope, anyway. That's my prayer that I'm putting out into the ether right now.
Yeah, they're definitely more mindful of how society like should be in a sense. We're all working out the bugs, obviously. You know, just to find that balance between what kind of our lives were when we were kids, and how they are and what they're dealing with. Because when we were young, you know, I remember talking to my grandfather, who was like the greatest generation or whatever, and him being like, oh my God, you're living in this post-apocalyptic, like, you know, as a kid in the 80s, you're like, you're living in this post-apocalyptic world. It's horrendous. And I'm like, seems pretty cool to me. I mean, there's E.T. and there's Star Wars and there's like, and, you know, Transformers and it was, you know, no freaking cell phones and like, I don't know. I didn't think it was horrible. I thought he was just an old man, like, you know, complaining about, but I bet you when he was a kid, it was a pretty blissful, if you were to go back. But also, it was right before the Second World War. I mean, when he was a kid. So I don't know. I don't know. I feel like every generation prior is thinking, oh my God, this poor generation.
See,
worse and worse.
I think our generation is actually, like, at least coming from my purview, I'm thinking this next generation is going to be phenomenal. I'm the exact opposite. I don't think
after Z. What's after Z, though? I don't know what. If this is the last generation, what's the next generation?
I don't think they're the last generation. What I think is this next Gen Z, these kids really are delivering, like I said, on that promise of what we wanted, you know,
they're attempting to,
and I think they mean it. And they're what's driving culture right now. So for better or for worse, they are what we're kind of resting on.
Oh, I get it. I think you should always, you're always resting on the youth. And I feel like it takes a few generations, though, to from the ideas that they come up with. I feel like Gen X, we kind of like didn't force things. We just kind of went with it. Our language was sarcasm. Our whole thing was like kind of, you know, screw authority, punk rock, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like the millennials kind of in between, and then Gen Z, I feel like, is trying to make the world a much better place, and for everything to be, but you're wrestling it from, like I said, from generations prior that don't want to give it up, and you're also trying to force the world into something that you, which we didn't do, I don't feel like, as much as these generations do, but it's going to take a little time. It's hard to force that stuff. You can't just do it in a generation. So I think it's just like planting seeds. Every generation plants seeds, hopefully for better, but just the world just is getting, it's just getting harder and harder to, I mean, we might not even have an Earth if you really think about it, by the time that they figure it out, we all figure it out, that it could be the end.
But what's kind of the hope that I have right now is the fact that these kids that are listening to your music and listening to the music of our generation, and they really love our generation's music, and they're taking those values, and once, like, they're not going to be in power for another 15, 20 years, these kids, in all reality, because they, no one comes into their own until their 40s and 50s, it seems like, especially in the political milieu. Yeah. Once they take control, fuck, man, we might have it dicked, or it might be too late. Regardless, we're going to have some great music that's going to carry us into the final moments, which I find ironic, because a great amount of what's cutting through the static right now is, it's catching up with you guys, what you've done and what you've been doing for quite a long time now. It seems like everyone else is catching up with you finally and figuring out, like, oh shit, no, this was really as good as the generations before me said it was. And you're not necessarily like, okay, we're just like the Cure and Echo and the Bunny Man and this one and that one, but you're kind of culling from all of that and shooting it through your own prism. And it's still unique and vibrant. What I wonder is how you discern, you say there's like 70 some songs on a hard drive. Mm-hmm. How do you separate the wheat from the chaff there? Or is it all just like, okay, this is what we're going to do now, and we're going to use this for this part? Or is it all kind of more like a happenstance thing?
I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of crappy stuff on that drive. I don't know. I feel like we're getting better and better over time at getting to the recording and the realizing the songs and also the thing about this record, I think too, is we try to not waste a lot of time. We try to get the songs into 3 to 4 minute, you know, we're not meandering for 7 minutes like we maybe have done in the past. I don't know. It's kind of hard to how do we pick stuff. I mean, it's just kind of like, I think it's just things that work together when we decide. We might get one song where it's like, oh, this is really cool. Oh, this batch of four songs is great. What have we done before that might work with these now? That's how we've done it in the past. Like I said, maybe moving forward, we'll go like, hey, let's write a record that's like, we're going to start it right now from scratch and everything from this point forward, and we're not going to take anything from the past. That might be interesting. We've never done that. But yeah, usually it's just like of 70 different moods and different vibes and different feelings and different time periods of what we were doing, and then sifting through that. And sometimes you'll go back, right? We listen to this stuff a lot, like while walking around. You'll go back and say, hey, that song we did a while ago is pretty cool. I'll go back and I'm like, oh, I thought that was crap, and that's actually pretty good now, you know, like, because I forgot we even wrote it. Like, there's that much stuff, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I think there was a certain idea as far as like, I mean, I think a lot of these songs have a driving kind of, you know, quality to them that they kind of fit together well. And I think that was kind of a conscious decision for some of it. But yeah, other than that, I mean, as far as like, you know, like themes or anything of it, like it's all over the map. So like, it's just kind of pulling them in and then kind of putting the puzzle together in reverse a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah. We're weird that way. But, you know, we have the luxury, like, you know, back in the day, you'd have to be David Bowie or somebody to be able to have a budget to go into a studio and just spend forever in there tweaking stuff. And like, when I was younger, it would be like, okay, we have these six songs that we learned in rehearsal. Let's go and try the best we can while we're watching the clock to have some like engineer that barely knows what he's doing most of the time, just get us to get a demo together or a record. Right. Like now I could spend a day on a guitar tone. I try not to be, cause it takes a lot of the coolness about it if it's too perfect. Like I like things to be a little raw, right? So like, sure. but I could spend all day on a guitar tone, and that's pretty amazing that this little setup that we have here that we can actually do that whenever we want. So we can really experiment with anything. Like I didn't even sing like this until I had my own studio. Both me and Ben pretty much came into our, like the thing that we do vocally through experimentation recording. Prior to that, I was just always like very shy. So it'd be very whispery toned stuff. Like the early Palm Ghost records are very whispery.
Yeah.
For that reason, it was a different type of music, but it was like, yeah, it was all, it's all this time that we have to do this, which is great.
It makes everything like an afterthought, you know. I mean, it's like you don't need to, when you have accessibility to something as much as like we do recording or just making music, like there's not a ton of like planning or intention in the front end, because it's just like, look, we like to create, we're creating, and then we just create all this stuff, and then it's like everything else is, you're just putting it together after all that's done, you know. It's like he said, you're not going in with like six songs that you've already considered your strong songs and you're pushing them through and you're trying to, we're just making songs, and then by the end of it, like, we're just, you know, this is cool for this song and this is cool for that, and then when you get them together, like, oh, we'll put these together and that makes a record.
Yeah, but before the home recording revolution, you know, I feel like the way I used to be in bands, and you probably have been in bands, and all of us that play music, is you get together with friends that had similar musical tastes, and then you just bang on crap in a basement, or you write a song on acoustic guitar or whatever your instrument is, and you show it to the guys, and you're like, hey, I have this song, and then it's like just jamming and noise and trying to figure out vocal melodies and like, took forever to do it, and then you'd finally get something that you thought was pretty good, and then you'd record it and you go, "Ooh, you're doing that? Like, that's nuts. I thought you were doing that, and this sounds like garbage." And then you have to go to that and fix all that, and then you have a song. So when people would spend like years writing before they'd even go into a studio, that's why their first record was always like, that's why they always attribute your first record with like your best work.
And then the sophomore slump.
Yeah, that's all based off of like, you know, $300 an hour recording studios, from what I understand. Because like, I feel like you get better at music the more you work at it.
Yeah.
Should be that way. Just like the more you write, the better novels you write, or everything you do, you're supposed to get better and more sensitive to the nuances of it and make better work. Painters, you could be Pablo Picasso and be 96 and have created your masterpiece. They're not looking at what he did at 18 as some sort of like wonderful thing, like Warhol. They came into their own through life. But musicians, somehow we're expected to come up with the best crap before we're 25, and then after that we're just sold down the river as some sort of, and I always see that as those memes that have people say, like, you know, budding pop star, you know, record label failure, old guy with a home studio, and it's still instilling this idea with younger people, like, oh, you have to be this, like, you have to be 18 to be vital. And I think it's the stupidest thing in the world. Like, most of the music made by 18, if you go back now and listen to some of those early records, they're made for 18-year-olds. I mean, there's music made for 18-year-olds by 18-year-olds, and there always has been. Doesn't mean, like, I don't know, the Beatles were another one. Like, their first stuff was not the best. To me, their best stuff
was... It was
like,
derivative. Their first stuff was very derivative. They did...
Yeah, you learn. Yeah.
Rubber Soul onward, leaps and bounds greater and more expansive and more revolutionary,
right,
as so they went along.
So why are we told that like our early work is not us personally, but like people that are musicians, your early stuff is better. After that, it's just crap. Like I won't even listen to your fifth record because obviously by that point you're garbage. Is that because bands became like really rich and famous at that point, and then they just became, you didn't even want to work on the music or the art? They weren't hungry anymore, so what they did was just threw out stuff for the labels. I don't know. I don't know what that's about, but I hate that stigma.
Well, it was the burnout of rock stardom. I think I want to really pin that on, because like Led Zeppelin, a lot of people bemoan Presence and Coda. I think those are incredible records personally, but a lot of people bemoan them because, you know, they became dinosaurs at that point. We're talking about a 12 year span before that. They were the new Yardbirds, but people think that the immediacy of the first record is always like that pinnacle moment, and as if they'd captured lightning in a bottle, when in all reality, like you said, they're probably working on that record for 5 fucking years, and then they're rushing out the next product, because once you become famous, you have to keep making product. You have to be McDonald's. You have to make the same burger again and make it as good as the last one. Whereas coming from our world, the independent music world, you would think it would be different, but in all reality, it's still like a fetishization of youth culture. Once hardcore bands, for example, stopped making 7 inches with 10 songs and started making albums with 10 songs that were bigger in scope, with more instrumentation and more thoughtfulness and more worldliness involved, they sold out because it became artsy, and we don't want that. Like, fucking forbid that. Thankfully, I think that's kind of in the rear view too, because even in pop music, it's become more of a game of chess with these people and less about fetishization of youth, which is kind of like a through line to this record again, because you guys have been making music for, you know, the better part of what, 16, 17 years together, if not better. This is the best thing you've come up with so far. This is the best record you guys have done, and I like everything that came before. And I think that has a lot to do with living in a sound for a long time and aging into it and maturing. I think maturity in music really has its place, and that's what makes it timeless. Sure, we all think that I Want to Hold Your Hand is a fun song, but I'd rather listen to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Looking Through a Glass Onion, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I also think a lot of musicians, what they do, bands, once they get some sort of success, even on a small level today, they try to write records for their perceived fan base, what they want to hear, mm-hmm. and they look for bland records. So a band becomes pretty big, and we have this problem too, right? We always kind of think about, like, is this too far outside the box or outside the line? Not that we're writing for anybody, not that we have a huge fan base, but it's a situation where it's like, you know, we're perceived by press or whatever as this type of band or whatever. So do we switch that up? Do we change that? Do we put in something that's, and we're always like, yeah, let's do that. So the things change quickly. But in that sense, you could. Everybody's got a different record they like, or they got a different sound that they like, I think, that we do. From what I hear, people have their favorites. But yeah, I think that's when you start writing for your brand or whatever you think your fan base wants, I think that's trouble. And I think a lot of the great bands throughout history, including like David Bowie or like the Beatles, like we're talking about, all of them never did that. They just wrote. They wrote for what they wanted to do and expected the people that liked that band to follow them on that journey if they wanted to, or they would drop off. And if they drop off, some new people hop on the train. And I feel like that's the fear, is like people are going to drop off. You can't fear that.
No.
Because there's always going to be new people that jump on the train to replace those people if you're doing it right, if you're making quality stuff. That's
what. But to your point about people having their favorites with you, mm-hmm. What I find, I guess in my own opinion, the last three records have been my consecutively my favorite record. What you're building to me for me and to me, what you're building into your sound, only it has greater returns as you go. There's always something that grabs me that about, you know, this new thing that comes down where you're not resting on the laurels of the last record. Because if let's take this record and go back to the first Palm Ghosts record, you're talking about kind of like basically an indie rock style record versus something that has so much nuance and pulls from so many different touch points as far as music culture are concerned, that you kind of can't even put your finger like, oh, they must like The Cure, or they must like Texas Is the Reason, or Pavement, or like name a really cool independent band. And somehow you guys have harnessed all these things. And
that's great. Thank you.
But you have an honest history with it all. It's not like you're just saying, okay, this was cool to these people then, so we're going to throw this in the stew now too. Because I mean, it's, you wouldn't still be doing it at the level you're doing it if you were faking it.
Yeah. So you're saying like the very first Palm Ghost record was basically me learning how to record and me trying to get out of this clinical depression I was speaking about. So I was like in this warehouse in Philly, it was super cold. I'm not painting that picture to make it more romantic, but like it was horrendous. And yeah, it was freezing in there. And I just worked through this winter and put out that record. And Walt, who's on the record now, we played together since we were kids. So he was on that record. And then I moved to Nashville and then I met Ben. So when I came to Nashville and met Ben, the record started changing. Like the first record was basically me again recording in a spare bedroom. But Ben, I was working on Ben's music at the time and we were working together on stuff and he contributed to a lot of the stuff that was on that record. Then it became like, let's do this as a band, right? And that was 2018. And then we decided, let's do this as a band. We got other members and it was a band with two voices and a whole bunch of different stuff. Me and Ben mostly wrote most of the stuff, I think, on that. Jason started writing some stuff. And then like, you know, then it was stripped down. But I think all the distillations of stuff that you're here, so I grew up like, you know, like liking metal and liking hardcore and liking, punk rock and new wave music and just everything. I loved so much like what you'd call alternative music growing up. I'd be on the bus with my headphones on listening to Helmet and like Minor Threat and Beastie Boys, just anything like just a wide range of stuff. My Bloody Valentine. Ben was like growing up listening to like Elliott Smith, and I don't know what the first band you got into though. What was like when you were a kid? What was your like?
As a kid, I don't know. I mean, I had a lot of punk stuff from my brother. My brother was a Deadhead, and he'd get punk records, and he got hip hop. So I'd get all that.
Sounds like a Gen Z kid.
Yeah, kind of.
He's only 4 years older than me, but like he had some older friends, so like he'd kind of hand stuff down to me. I'd get like a Dead Kennedys record and like a Hot Tuna record from him. You know?
That's awesome, though. To me, like
it really is. Yeah,
that's my youth. You're speaking about coming from hippie parents, and you know, Greg Ginn being the Deadhead that he was.
Yeah,
I didn't even really put that together when I was a kid, but my dad was in Vietnam, mom was a hippie, the Dead were a big force in my life, and so were the fucking Black Flag, to be honest. Yeah. It's all honest.
I loved the Dead. I liked the Dead a lot.
Me too.
Fun. So yeah, I mean, yeah, the Kinks. I love the Kinks. Oh, I love God. Like, you know, like I said, so it's all that stuff. Ben's in the like the, you know, Lemonheads and what do you call like
Elvis Costello
saved my life.
Yeah,
really
saved my life, legitimately saved my life. Yeah, that's what I listened to when I was in when I was getting clean exclusive.
Oh, wow.
Impacting. Like it is kind of he's like got this snarky attitude enough to where it's like it kind of makes you feel tougher inside in a way. Like
yep, this year's model and
record. Yeah, my favorite.
I wouldn't be off of heroin without Elvis Costello and the Attractions. Cool. Fucking, that is hard stop the truth. Absolutely.
That's killer.
But you can take all of these things and you know, they're so far flung and disparate, and still find a place for them on a very cohesive record. That has to be just lightning in a bottle. There's something very magical about what you guys do, that it continues to have these greater returns. How do you form that? How do you still put that into the world and keep that same fire behind it? Because it can't be easy.
Oh, I don't know. I just love music. I mean, I don't even know how to explain. Like for years, I always played music since I was 13 years old, and played guitar, started with guitar and shredding and all that crap. And I always loved it. I always identified myself by music. Like it was strictly music. But then I was like, well, I got to go to college and I got to do all this stuff. So like it was back burner. And it also, there was a period of time where it was about the party. It was like going on tour. Like I would always say, we'd start our tour at the Bog. This was how we started talking last time. And yep. I just wasted with Brian and like just completely blitzed. The rest of the tour is just a joke, because we didn't even take our merch out back in the day and past bands. It was just about partying. You know what I mean? And like,
yeah.
And I think like, when I moved to Nashville, I had to get out of Philly. I love Philadelphia, but it was like where I grew up, and I was like, I just have to separate myself from all this. I feel like it's stale for me at the time. So coming to Nashville, it was like, oh, all these musicians, they have these kind of careers. Like they're like this blue collar people touring all the time, and it's not a joke to do that here. You're not looked at as like a fool. So I started taking like just music way more seriously. I'm like, I'm going to dedicate all my time to music as much as I can. And Ben, I guess, came down here with the same kind of thought patterns. And when we met, it was all about like, it's just all about working on stuff. So I never feel like there's burnout. I never feel like we have to do, like, we'll take periods where there's no recording at all. You know what I mean? Or there's always recording. Like I'm always down here. Like I said, it's part of my mental health, like, regimen. But like, there might be periods where like one song, like right now, one song got done over couple weeks. Usually during the Lifeboat Candidate, it was like three songs a week sometimes. I just let those things ebb and flow. I don't go out of my way to, like, you know, say, oh, you haven't been down there, what's wrong with you? Or like right now we're doing a lot of playing, touring, and like trying to get this record out and all that stuff. So it's more about that, performing. But there's going to be a period at the end of the year where we're not going to be doing anything for a couple months, and that's when we do a lot more recording and stuff. And but I just never, there's no pressure. Like we never think like, what are we going to do next? We got to get something. Like, it's more like, you know, I don't know, I want to be consistent with what we do. I don't want people to say like, oh, they really fell off with this one. Like, you know what I mean? But sometimes, you know, we haven't really had that. I think we just,
No, because you guys positioned yourselves in such a manner, in my opinion, that everything you do is just different enough that everyone expects it to be a little bit different, but it's still rooted in the same mood and mode. That how are you going to fall off? As long as you're still, you know, you guys, like, how the fuck is it going to go wrong? It just so happens that this record, just like the last record and the record before it, is my favorite record thus far.
Yeah, nice. Thanks. I love this. I'm just like, oh, this record's pretty good. This record's pretty good. I'm really proud of this one. I just like this record a lot. I did from the beginning, and like, you know, and like I said, Tim, who released, it's the first record, we could get into that, but like, he really also, we talked a lot about how much he cared about it, and like him trying to get us, you know, picked up by people first, and then him deciding I'm going to do this, and I'm going to find this coalition, I guess, if you would, to put it out, and like just really believed in this stuff. And it's just nice to have a person that's like a champion of yours that way, like that's truly into it, like not doing it for any reason other than that he loves it, and he's, which is the whole reason why he works in PR and the things that he does. Yeah, I don't know. So it's like, it's weird. Like, we'll play like goth nights, right? And we'll do a lot of that stuff, a ton of it. And they seem to like it, so okay. And then we'll go and we'll play like with metal bands, and they seem to be okay. And then we'll play like with rockabilly, or we're just all over the map. emo bands, whatever. We always work with these different bands, and it always seems to resonate. Like, we're just like we're really just an alternative rock band. If you want to go right back to the beginning of what it was, I don't want to say indie rock, I don't want to say post-punk, any of the stuff that, like, you know, the genres that we've all distilled it into, you know, it's indie rock, it's indie independent rock, it's alternative rock. Like, that's the stuff I love, that I grew up with, and I like to say that. I like to keep that notion alive.
Well, think about it. It encompasses everyone from My Bloody Valentine to Quicksand to, like, you know, some of these great touchstones like Seaweed and fucking, like,
nice. Yeah.
They come from, all of them come from our world some way or another with punk.
120 minutes.
Yeah, 120 minutes is really, yeah. It's our world. It was our generation's mecca. You know, this is where we went to worship. Yo MTV Raps, 120 minutes, Headbangers Ball, the Holy Trinity, right? Yeah. So as long as you're pulling from these sources, you're not going to go wrong, because there was so much love put into these things. And that's where you guys are coming from, where I'm coming from, where Tim is coming from. And a lot of times when you guys are not involved, Tim and I, we talk about Palm Ghosts, like, those are that band, like, nice. 2 years ago when I first, like, when Tim first started, over 2 years ago when Tim first started working with me and helping me out, you know, you guys came up and I was like, yeah, they come up, they know my friend Brian, like, at the Bog, you know, before Brian passed. I was like, that band is fucking special, because they're not trying to be this guy over here with this post-punk thing, or this guy with this revival. They're just like, they're doing Palm Ghost music, and that's important. That's special. Right. And for it to build into Tim, you know, going into his first venture of putting his fucking money where his mouth was, and I'm putting this into the fucking world, yeah, and pulling together, like, kind of a Justice League of record labels to do it, like a Voltron of record labels.
Labels unite. Yeah.
It's fucking great. That's special, because how many people can you say, how many bands can you say have had that many labels get together to say, we believe in this enough to put this into the world? That's very unique.
It went from zero labels to four in, like, zero time.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
More ads than a race car on the record. Brought to you by Heinz.
Yeah, it's like a table mat in a diner with all that. Yeah.
All I need is a couple crayons and something to color in on the back, and we're good.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, well, I'm thankful for those guys, and especially Tim. I mean, Tim is the guy that really connected us with everybody. And, you know, he's the one that's done all the PR work for it, and, like, just spent, like, so much time. And then whenever we go to Dayton and play, like we just did, you know, he treats us like gold. It's just, you know, he's just a great guy. So, like, it's just like, yeah, because, so it's funny, like, you always say, like, how you're hearing all this different stuff. Like, we'll play, like, the Mile Music Festival, which is generally, like, a lot of it is a lot of roots Americana music and stuff, and we play there. And we find these people come, and they're like, oh my God, like, this one guy is like, I grew up, I saw The Cure, like, I forget what tour it was, but it was like before Disintegration. It was probably like Head on the Door or something. And I grew up with all these bands I listened to in college. And he goes, I've never seen those bands when they were playing clubs. And he goes, this is what I feel like I'm doing right now. I'm discovering this band. And this guy was like mid-50s probably. And he's just like, you brought me back to like a teenager. And like, it's not a nostalgia thing where your music is a song I remember and the relationship I had with that song when I was young, which is how a lot of that stuff works, but just it connected with him enough that he felt like it did the same thing to him. And I thought that was pretty wonderful. So we get a lot of people like that, you know,
because you're not sounding like, but if you're coming from those same touchstones, that,
yeah,
you're going to attract like minds. Okay. If you like I'm wearing a Cure hat right now. If you love, yeah, The Cure, and you love Minor Threat and Fugazi, and you love, like, you're going to attract people who love those things too, because subconsciously they're going to make their way into your music, whether you're channeling them or not.
We always laugh because every time we play a show, there's someone, it could be 20 something, 50 something, whatever. They all have a completely different band that we remind them of. We heard Sunny Day Real Estate. We've heard bands we've never heard
of. We've heard Rammstein.
Rammstein. Yeah. No, I'm just telling you, it's wild.
You mean Laibach? Oh, wait, I didn't say
that. Yeah, right, exactly. all this wild stuff, like Moving Units we heard recently. We heard, like, when's the last time you thought of Moving Units? Like, it's been a long time.
Yeah, pretty long time.
So it's just that's kind of cool. Like, I'm just like, all right, so let's, on the way home to the hotel, like, let's listen to what these people thought we sounded like. And I'm like, okay, I guess we hear REM a lot. Like, I'm not even a huge REM fan, but we hear it a lot. I mean, I there was a period of REM when I was younger that I loved, but like, I'm not a super fan by any stretch of the imagination.
Because I'm bald and I do that fake clap hand
thing. Oh, yeah, that's true. You do. Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, if you're from Pennsylvania, which some of us are, remember when Live was the thing like to love, like when, the EP before Jewelry, the EP before Mental Jewelry came out, everybody was like, oh, Live, they're a REM ripoff band, what are you loving so much?
And he always makes fun, he goes, our next record is going to be called
what?
You always say that, Live record,
Secret Samadhi. is that what it is?
We put that all one time, like, I never listened to Secret Samadhi. I'll never get that time back.
None of us listened to Secret Samadhi because, you know something? Live sucked. I'm sorry.
It took you a record to figure it out.
Ed Kowalczyk.
Someone's going to get mad at us or mad at you for saying that. You
know? I really don't care. I mean, I lived through it. Okay. I remember when Mental Jewelry came out and all my friends were trying to sell me on this record. And I was like, I already own Green. Why are you trying to sell me Green? I own that fucking record, man.
Without the tunes. Actually, also, Ed Kowalczyk spit water out into the audience. My wife was in the audience and spit right at her. She didn't even, and she just hated them since then.
Ed Kowalczyk spit on my wife.
Yeah. Pretty much. So she's not cool with it.
So Secret Samadhi is not in my house.
And I can't do that. You know. So there you go. There's your connection to Live that we have to Live.
Well, our only connection to Live is Pennsylvania. That's it. That's it. And that's all. But the idea that Live exists is for the same reason we all exist, which is, you know, there was that era in the 80s where everything became cool for a brief moment. You know what I mean? Because you could get the Sisters of Mercy getting huge, and you can get REM getting huge, and of all things, Husker Du. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there was a time when everything went, and then that died down quick. And then in the 90s, when we were teenagers, that happened again.
Yeah.
Every generation has this uptick of music with heart getting bubbling up to the mainstream again. I don't know if there's a mainstream anymore. I really don't.
I think like pop is like they're probably Dua Lipa or like, you know, a lot of the stuff that's pop. There's always been pop.
Mainstream rock though.
Oh, no, rock. I just heard recently, I thought it was kind of interesting. There hasn't been a rock song on the charts, on the Billboard charts since 2001. That's kind of surprising to me.
And who was on the charts at that time? Foo Fighters or
rock band? I forget who it was. It was probably like a I don't know, Nickelback or something, you know,
Three Doors Down,
one of those one of those fools. They're probably lovely people, but I'm saying, like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so that's probably why rock hasn't been on the charts since then. Rock hit this kind of weird wall where it's like it became so derivative and this insane and like and not interesting at all. You knew what was coming next all the time. That's like a curse, like in music. At least some of the pop stuff and a lot of the newer hip hop stuff, if you listen to the production, you're like, whoa, this is coming from all these different directions. And it's somewhat interesting to me as far as like, if you put on headphones and listen to it.
Yeah.
It goes places where you don't expect it to go. But rock was just very formulaic at that point. And I and when people do rock revival type stuff now, which I guess like Måneskin and like all these bands that are kind of like doing the retro rock thing again, there's a lot of them doing like 80s rock coming back again.
Mm-hmm.
It all just, I'm like, oh, here's this blues riff again, and here's this, like, here's the bridge and here's the breakdown. And it's just not saying that what we do is some sort of magical, but I think what we try to always do is we always think one thing that we always do with every song, we're like, we would like to get something here that surprises the listener at some point in the song. Like it develops or it takes it to a different place, or it's just trancey thing that just kind of brings you in that way. But like I try to stay away from formula. And I think a lot of rock is just formulaic. So people are like, this is so boring.
Yeah.
It was 30, 40 years of formula, you know?
And what I think another kind of special thing that you bring to the rock milieu is the fact that it's not contrived, that it's not coming from a place of bravado and you know, overly pumped masculine nonsense, which it seems to be like when people say, oh, it's rock music, they're thinking of like really shitty second rate Guns N' Roses, which, you know, even Guns N' Roses were very fucking good when Appetite came out anyway. And Lies. But like, you know, they think of like second rate Aerosmith, like, you know, just shitty male energy, like rape culture bullshit. And that's when you say rock to me, that's not what I think of. I think of the Beatles. I think of like the Stones. I think of the Sisters of Mercy, you know?
Yeah. Well, they created that, made it exciting. And I think that like it hit a wall, and then like bands continued to make it exciting through the whole alternative thing, I think.
Yeah.
And then around late 90s, 2000s, it kind of lost the plot a little bit. But maybe it's time, you know what I mean, for something to come back around rock-wise. I mean, I don't know if there's no monoculture anymore, right? So it's not like we can market. Like, people don't market, like, this band is going to be huge because we're going to put all our money behind this. It's going to be on every TV show. Nobody watches the same thing. Nobody listens to this. Nobody reads the same things anymore. So the monoculture was a vehicle to get these bands to be huge. Even if we didn't like them at first, you knew them, and like, they were always in your face.
Yeah.
I don't know if that exists anymore. I don't think there's enough money in the world to do that for an artist. That's why Spotify, like, some of the biggest stuff in the world is stuff from like Latin stuff and like world music, and it's all over the map. And like, and kids that listen to streaming stuff, they're not like us where you walk into school the first day and, oh, there's the dude with the Minor Threat jacket. Oh, and there's the guy with the Metallica patch. And like, you knew who your people were and you'd go and meet them.
Yeah.
None of that, I don't think, is much anymore. Not that fashion is no longer there, but like, I think they listen to everything. A lot of kids will listen to everything.
They have a hoodie and a Blowfish hat and a Minor Threat jacket.
You know? Yeah. I think they do. You know what I mean? That's a good point.
You don't know if you got to hit him or if he's going to hit you.
The Dolphins make him cry, though.
The Dolphins do make him cry, but the thing is, you have to wonder, does he own Screwdriver all screwed up? That's when you start to get weird.
Right? No, but it's honestly, man, like, I think it's like streaming, everything is at your fingertips now. So I understand a kid's not going to want to listen to one type of thing. They're like, oh, what's going on here? And they're playing video games mostly. So it's like, what's on in the background that keeps my game going? You know what I mean? What's exciting for them? It's usually upbeat stuff. It's usually like quicker stuff. You know what I mean? I don't know. Well, but then you got big rock bands, Turnstile. Look what they're doing. Like, out of nowhere.
They're fucking great. Like, for a hardcore band.
Yeah,
to cut through the noise and incorporate like excellent productions from people like Blood Orange, mm-hmm. in hardcore. I've had so many people in my age group and our age group criticize me specifically for like, oh God, you're wearing a Turnstile t-shirt. Dude, like, I went to see Gorilla Biscuits with you. What the fuck are you doing? I was like, listening to good music. What the fuck are you doing, man?
I know, man.
Like, give it up.
High Viz is a band I really like.
They're great. Oh my god, are they great? They take hardcore. Yeah. They take hardcore and post punk.
Exactly. And I'm like, oh, I love this stuff. And I've sent it to some friends, and there's like no response. And I'm just like, okay, man. Like, you're gonna keep going to your the Quicksand reunion, or like go see whoever you're gonna go see, but you won't listen to this. And like, it's just that's the curmudgeon old guy thing I can't stand. Is when
in my heart, Trauma Bonds is a hit.
Yeah, that's like
in the perfect world, the song Trauma Bonds by High Viz is a fucking number one hit on 120 minutes.
Yeah.
And what's his face with the leather jacket and the finely quiffed hair, British gentleman, I forget his name, the host. He's announcing them that they should, that's what they should be. And in a way, even though they're not selling moving units like that, they are. Because
they're very successful in what they do. Idols, another band, doing huge all over. Who would think a band with that much English swagger would be big in the United States as they are?
Yeah. The last time that much English swagger kind of broke through in the United States was probably the Smiths.
Very different energy, but yes.
Yeah, different energy. Same thing with The Cure. The Cure always resonated in the States because, I don't know, there was always a mopey kid in class who, you know, loved getting depressed and wallowing in it, like myself. But there's a space to inhabit in between all of that, in between that kid that mopes over in the corner and the kid that wants to go see Turnstile and fuck shit up. And interestingly enough, that middle ground is Palm Ghosts.
Yeah. True. We'd tour with either one of those, and I think we'd fit in just fine.
You do, because there's no you're not flying a flag over here.
Yeah, just trying to make good music. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, we're gonna start cry moshing. Is gonna be a thing. We're
crying. That already happened at Lifetime shows. Don't you remember, bro?
That was probably an emo centric. That was probably an emo thing. Yeah.
No, in all truth, I mean, if you're gonna create something that's intellectually and emotionally pure, you don't necessarily have to pick a side anymore, because your side is already your own music and your own psyche. That's fun for me to take that journey, to go on like the next leg of your journey. Is that limiting to you at all, or do you find that completely liberating as I do?
Is what limiting? That we don't have like a specific thing?
That you don't have anything to lean on. It's just
your
measuring stick is the last Palm Ghost.
I look at it as like the three of us get along really well. We hang out all the time, even here, you know what I mean? And like always working on music, always doing stuff. We get to go and play music, and like and if there's more than, you know, 10, 20 people, even if there's less and they're nice, it's great to be able to play for people, and it's great to be able to continue to release. We were doing it ourselves, releasing everything ourselves, putting it out, pressing the CDs and all that stuff in vinyl, all on our own. Now we have a little like group of people that like Tim and those guys, or Tim especially, like who want to continue to work with us and help us achieve goals or get to more ears or whatever. I love it. I just love the opportunities that we've had. Like, I think there's a lot of stuff we did this year that when I was younger, I was never like, I would always sing and play guitar, but I was always kind of, I was shy. You know what I mean? That's always kind of like a shy guy in that way. I'm not shy to talk to people, but like when you're in front of a bunch of people. So I remember playing as a sideman in different bands, like, oh, I could never do this big audience. That's crazy. Or I could never play that big stage, or like, I could never be on the radio or any of that stuff. It always scared me. And I'd always kind of like I always wanted to do it, but I never thought I could. This year we did a lot of stuff that I didn't think a lot of stuff that makes you nervous, that when you get through it, you do it, you're like, oh, that was good. That was like another level that we just, for us personally, like playing Summerfest, playing a big stage, and like
opening for Modern English.
Opening for Modern English. And that was live on the radio here on Lightning 100 in front of a huge crowd that we'd never met. And that went really well for us. And like all those little things that we do. And then you're just like, you know what? This is great. I love to be able to do this still. because I, you know, lifelong love affair with music, going in and out of it. We both, in different times in our lives, quit music for periods of time, saying this is a kid thing. What are we doing? And somehow here we are, you know, like middle aged, and we're like, we're playing this music that we love, and it's resonating with people of all ages, and we get to play music for people, and all these little surprises, like, oh wow, these people really enjoy it, or you hear all these. I don't know. I love it. It's not daunting at all. I would love to continue to do this as long as humanly possible, and just continue to release stuff if people want to listen to it. And even if they don't, it's still going to be stuff released. You know what I mean? It's kind of like Guided by Voices. I'm sure there's somebody out there listening to the 15 records that were released this year by it.
I have been.
Yeah. I love them. I'm just kidding. I'm just saying, like, you know, we're like, so we just release so much stuff. Like, do people really want to hear this much music? Apparently they do.
You know, you'll always find an audience if you mean what you're doing.
Yeah.
Is it overkill?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you burning me out? Do I have the money to keep up with it? No.
Yeah.
Exactly. Absolutely not. But God bless them. At least they're trying.
They are. He still kicks it, like, on stage. He still
He's great on stage. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But like, for as that quantity that keeps pouring out of Guided by Voices, we get quality out of you guys. It's just it's a constant barrage that happens once a year or two of really good, concise 10-12 songs, boom. And you don't have to question it, because it reinvents itself every time. There's never a point where you're like, why am I listening to this, because it sounds just like the last one. You never sound like the last one.
That's good. That's really where it's at for us. I feel like, you know, there's going to be songs that might remind you of another, of maybe a previous record, or like the vibe. It's like, but, you know, and I don't know if we also think, like, let's make something completely different. I think it's just a very nice, natural progression.
That's what it is. There's never that tectonic shift where it's like, oh my God, they just made a fucking, like, you know, Soca record.
Yeah. Nothing is forced, man. Like, we just look at it as like, wow, we get to do this, and there's actually people that listen to it, and that's really cool.
So what moves the needle for you guys now musically? Like, if we were to pull out like a name or two out of the atmosphere of what you currently listen to that is really, you know, inspiring you, moving you forward, or opening your soul up to music.
I mean, I just told you a couple bands that I like. High Viz is a band I like, and there's a lot of bands that I listen to and I like. There's that band Pale Blue Eyes I thought were kind of cool. There was that Just Mustard. It was kind of cool. He did some really cool guitar stuff on that record. Working Man's Club I thought was kind of cool. That first record really kind of hit me. It was doing something that was a little different. You know, I think I always look for something that's a little bit different than just the same kind of, like, I love Joy Division, and I love Bauhaus, and I love all that stuff I grew up with. I feel like a lot of bands these days, you know, are in that gear, and a lot of them sound samey to me. Some of them, I don't know, but like, sometimes I'll hear a new role, I'm like, oh, it sounds a lot like this or that. So I try to just get outside of that completely and go into more aggressive music sometimes, like High Viz or like Idols, or I don't know what or shoegazy stuff. I like a lot of like stuff that sounds more shoegazy, or more like My Bloody Valentine or Slow Dive I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. I listen so much every day, and I also listen to a lot of podcasts too, so there might be some days where I don't listen to a lot of music, but
right.
Yeah, what about you? Anything newish that you're
I don't know about.
There's a lot of bands that we play with that are cool.
Yeah, I don't know about new stuff. I'm still digging into a lot of old stuff that I missed out on the 80s. So, like, I'm kind of retro diving into a lot of things that I didn't listen to growing up. Like, I didn't have a big Joy Division experience, you know, unlike a lot of people. I mean, I've actually recently, like, I'd sat down and started listening to Unknown Pleasures. I never really, like, sat down and listened to Unknown Pleasures before.
Wow.
Just looking through trying to take it in. I mean, really, because...
I wish I could listen to that for the first time
again. Me too. I'm like, my wow was a jealous one, because I first listened to it in, like, 1987? Six or seven? And I was probably... I was young, but I was maybe a little too young to fully understand.
Me too.
The nuance of it. And I got to grow up with it. So Ben, your experience with it must be a completely different bent because it's so informed. Like you have context.
And listening to like those early modern English records, I didn't really listen to a lot of those. Records, yeah. Like those were really cool. And I watched like a Pill documentary and I always heard some Public Image Limited songs, but I never listened to like some of the weirder records. And so I was trying to get in, you know, I try to find stuff that I didn't really devote time to like before that I might've heard bits and pieces of that. We have this guy in Canada that always sends us these links for like music that he's into. And like I was listening to the record, the Soul Mining record.
Great record. That's phenomenal.
Really enjoyed that. I actually had a friend listen to that tonight. I was listening to Cutworms tonight, actually, with Ryan, too. Mm-hmm. They're really fun, kind of a retro-sounding band. They're a newer one. Yeah, that new Teenage Fan Club record. I really enjoyed.
That's a juggernaut right there. I loved Teenage Fan Club when they came out. Not many bands. They're from Scotland, correct?
Yeah,
not many Scottish bands cut through, and wow, what a band to do it, you know?
No, it was really good, that new record. But they have older records that I didn't even really listen to. Like, it's hard to keep up with everything. Like, there's so many bands that like I did listen to for a while that have come out with like four records that I didn't even really. There's like Spotify, everything moves so fast, you know. It's like I looked over here for a little while, and now there's this whole cache of
Spotify is tough for me. Like I always listen to my like the Discovery Weekly, or that'll go to like the new releases of the bands that I follow.
Yeah.
Really, when I want to discover new music or I want to get into something new, I put on the BBC Six. Like, and I wake up and I put it on the app, and I'll listen to that most days. And I'll always find a band or two on there that I'm like, oh, this is cool. I mean, I'm just like an Anglophile. I just love British music.
Yeah, me too.
Much more than a lot of American stuff, personally. So like. That and rock and roll is still vital and alive in England, and there's lots of bands. Whereas here, I was just having conversations with people about how a lot of the bands we play with, there's no drummer, it's like duos, acoustic, or rather a keyboard and like tracks and stuff, which is fine. It's cheaper, and that's how people create these days. But like in the UK, it's still about the band, and I think that's pretty great.
It's organic.
Yeah, I love it. And a lot of them are really cool. Right, still trying to write hooky songs, which I love. I'm a sucker for a hook, you know?
Oh, sure.
But like, I don't know. Yeah, that's how I discover new stuff. But I'm sure there's about 30 different bands in the past month I've listened to that I could quote right now that I just can't even think, because there's so much of it. You know what I mean? And I go from band to band, but like...
But to me, like what you guys are talking about, like with the newer stuff specifically... it feels like a redo of the 90s insofar as there's such an array of new music that's great. Phenomenal, viable, and important. But there's that monoculture that you'd spoken of earlier comes into glaring focus because it doesn't matter how great any of them are. They're not going to kick off the way Nirvana did. Or you know, the way Dr. Dre and the Chronic did, or Oasis,
there's no engine for that anymore. There's always money. Obviously, there's more money, it seems to be, in the world than there's ever been. More billionaires, but like, I don't think you could spend $1 billion and get a band to be as big as Nirvana these days with $1 billion behind them, because. I mean, like that band Maneskin or whatever, they became huge because they were on that, it was a Eurovision.
Yeah.
How bizarre is that? Like, where did that come from? It's... Like, that's big here, too. Like that blows my mind that can happen. It's so, like, you cannot predict what people are going to go wild about.
Well, K-pop is this thing that, like, talk about, like... getting me in a disadvantage via age. My nieces and nephews who are like young, you know, like teenagers and stuff, they have this bent for K-pop, which is fine. That's great. I don't get it. I don't see the appeal. I don't. It doesn't.
No, it is. I know.
I don't even know what the fuck it is. I don't. I have no fuck. What the fuck's a K-pop? It's like pop music from Korea. I'm like, okay. How did you find it? And what do you,
boys?
So like, what are they finding on fucking ham radio? What's going on here? I don't understand.
That now. Ham radio rock would be a thing. If we're gonna like market a new rock band, they've only got to be heard on ham radio. You have to tune into one frequency in ham radio, and that's where that band will be. They'll be huge.
Fuck Zamrock. It's about ham rock.
No. Yeah, because a bunch of kids will be like, they'll learn on TikTok what's a ham radio, and all of a sudden they'll be into that band. We should try that experiment. It sounds like a great social experiment.
I still have my ham radio from when I was a kid. I was that geek.
All right, Palm, you know, Play Palm goes through. Tell them the station. We'll get some young TikTok to tell them they're like, this band I heard on ham radio. My my ancient, like, you know, grandfather's radio played this like haunting old rock music.
I think, you know what's sad or not sad? What's wonderful is I think it would work.
Yeah, because I.
So if we take it off Spotify and only make it available by ham radio,
ham
work.
Probably make more money that way.
How did we get weirder than the last time we were together?
That was
a tough one to beat.
What was the one that we said it was like post punk up your ass, or we said something about we tied in Metallica record with something? I forget what it was.
Yeah, we tied in Metallica. Oh, shit, it was Metallica and. I really want to say it was a Cure record, but I'm probably wrong.
We just combined them, into that,
But
yeah, we get deep.
we get deep, and you know, somewhere along the line, I think it's relatable to people so much younger than us because it all seems to come from the same place, no matter what. I think Kendrick Lamar comes from the same place that Joe Strummer came from.
Sure.
And people would probably take, you know, some issue with that. But if you really think about it, someone like a Kendrick Lamar, like, I don't know if either of you heard his last record, his most recent record.
I did. But Pimp a Butterfly, I love that record a lot.
That's pure fucking jazz, in my opinion. But
yeah, it's a great record.
His most recent record, he's talking about how he was like molested as a kid and stuff, and that rings true to me, and I have my relationship to that for my own personal reasons. But this is someone who is like a star, living their truth very, very bravely and openly and honestly, and doing it in a almost pop. Kind of if as pop as you can be in this day and age while still being a hip hop artist and a very direct hip hop artist. That's very punk to me. That's like as punk as Penny Rimbo and the Crass, you know. There's always going to be someone who you wouldn't expect to break through and be like brutally honest. I think Robert Smith was that person at one point. I think Morrissey, for as much as he broke my heart in a lot of ways,
Kurt Cobain,
in his very direct way. But you know, Morrissey, at least Kurt Cobain had the decency to be dead. Morrissey,
can I quote you on that?
You can, because at least that poor bastard didn't live to turn into shit.
Yeah.
Morrissey,
you think Kurt Cobain would have become a white nationalist?
No, I don't. No way. He was too punk rock for that. He was too pure for that.
I don't know. A lot of these guys get old and get weird.
Did Robert Smith didn't.
No. I'm not saying they all do. I'm saying sometimes you get surprised.
You get surprised. And the guy who got me into vegetarianism, and the guy who was honestly the poster child for, you know, the homosexual rock star. Even though he claimed to be asexual or non-sexual in his day, like it was Morrissey. He was counter to the counterculture. He was of his own, and to come out there, the guy who wrote, you know, the National Front Disco, to come out and wear a fucking Tory pin on his fucking tie on Larry King Live. Like,
he got comfortable, man. He got rich and comfortable. You know, that's what happened to him. He lost track of what he was from, and probably always wanted to get to where he is now. And there he is. And he's kind of like William Randolph Hearst in his like mansion up on the hill there.
But he's only like less than like 15 years off from Irish Blood, English Heart, This I'm Made Of. There's no one on earth. Dude, you're singing an anti-racist, anti-Britain, pro-Irish song, okay? You're pro-IRA in this song, supposedly. Yeah. And then like 12, 13 years later, you're a Tory?
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's wild.
And let's put aside the Chinese subhuman thing, because he was speaking strictly from a vegan perspective there. I understand what he was saying. He wasn't calling them subhuman. He was calling their actions toward animals subhuman. He didn't mean the country. I get that. I get that part. The part I don't get is, in your own country, in your own like culture and time period, you are supporting the same people 30 years ago you wrote a song against.
He's supporting them from Malibu in his mansion. He lived in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
No connection to England anymore. He doesn't even know what it is like to live there, probably. So he's probably coming at it as like I said, the guy on the hill, like looking at television and buying into whatever side of the aisle he was brainwashed to watch. He's been watching the wrong TV show.
He's a lazy sunbather now.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's sadly what it became. Now, like he's morphed into Tony Bennett. If Tony Bennett sucked, which he doesn't.
No, man, I feel like I'm at the point where like there are people that are literally getting completely different news than me and everybody else. And it blows my mind that these people like, because Marcy is an intelligent guy, obviously. He couldn't be brilliant. The world that he did. But like, you know, he's become old and grumpy and rich and like, and he's watching the wrong programs and he's believing what he's reading, that there's some sort of crisis. And that the conservatives are gonna solve it, which is I think a thing that's rooted in a lot of fear that we get in the United States
here. I just talked about that earlier tonight about fear, like the evil. Yeah. The root of evil is actually not greed; it's fear.
Yeah, like if you look at like a lot of political stuff, you see a one side saying like we want to take care of people and we're going to make these promises that they might not always keep, but they're saying these things. And then there's another side like, look out your window, these cities are crap, they're coming for you, you know. And then these people are living in this like small town in the middle of the country where they don't see anybody that looks any different from them for miles and miles, and they're like, they're coming for us, like a like that whole like stoking of fear, that's what that side's saying. So there's people that I guess just are afraid of it, and they just they believe it, and they just fall into it, and then they become pretty hateful because of it, because they're believing like that this they're believing what they're being fed by this news media on a lot of stuff, and it's sad. And I don't know, it's sad.
I thought people were coming for me, but they never did. And now I feel a little sad.
But like legitimately, we're not like we're far off, but we're not that far off from where Morrissey is age-wise right now. How do we continue to escape slipping in to that mindset? That's what perplexes me, because to me, I can't even fucking fathom going there. Period.
For me personally, it's like when we play shows all over the, whenever we tour and play shows, there's people of all cultures, genders, lifestyles that we meet on the regular that we talk to. And they're just really nice people. And there's people like that are working in gas stations that have Trump flags, who are also very nice when they check us out. And I'd say, had a nice day. Thank you. You have a nice day. And I think if you go out and you just like play for and meet just different people and you travel, I feel like that'll always stop you from getting that way. Now Morrissey obviously travels, but I feel like on his level, just because he was always like, he couldn't even be on the stage without people like trying to rip his clothes off.
Yeah.
Literally. that he travels in a bubble and like, and he doesn't see people on the regular. He just stands in his bus and people bring in his food. And I'm just assuming it's like that. So I feel like that for me, traveling with the band and otherwise is the thing that keeps me, my heart open to people because people are mostly good.
They are. They really are.
That.
Well, just actual interaction with other human beings, you know, like people lack that these days, you know, if they're online all the time or if they work from home or, you know, there's lots of things that just prevent us from being in a room talking to each other. So, I mean, like if just me being at work, me being, you know, around people, having conversations, you know, meeting people that think differently and not flipping out about it. Like it's, you know, it's, I don't know, if you put a little love out to all those people you run into and the different people you run into, that lets them know that not everybody out there is crazy and they affirm that for you as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the more you do that, the better off you are.
Yeah, just be a decent human to another human and accept that back. And if someone comes up with a MAGA hat, of course I'm going to be like, oh, that's just bad form. But if the guy says, hey, how you doing? I'm like, hey, how you doing, man? I'm not going to talk to him about politics. I'm not going to change his mind. But the very least I could do is be like, what's up? How are you? You know, do you need anything? Are you all right? Like, I don't know. I just feel like.
You're right. And let me posit this to you. I don't know if I have in our prior speaking, but taking into consideration when we were in the pandemic and the George Floyd thing happened, there was a lot of Antifa versus the fascists and stuff, and it's totally understandable for people to clash against fascism. I'm firmly against it, but there was one march in particular that comes to mind constantly, and I've brought it up a few times to people. There are neo-Nazis marching through an inner city area, and instead of there being rocks thrown at them and people flying in their face, which did happen at this rally, but there was one gentleman with dreadlocks, a dark-skinned gentleman, approaches one of these white nationalists who's Sieg Heiling, he's boots and braces Nazi, and he says to this guy, instead of punching him in the face or saying, fuck you, he grabs this guy and he said, yo, I don't hate you. Why the fuck do you hate me? Can you tell me why you hate me? And the guy had no answer. And he said, I'm going to give you a hug right now. Is that okay? And the guy just like, and he hugged him and he said, I love you. I don't hate you. Why do you hate me? And the guy said, I don't know. Maybe if we start to meet the people who are diametrically opposed to our belief systems with love instead of violence, which is everything that I was raised against acting like, because you know, the punk rock thing and the being birthed of a Vietnam veteran and a hippie, we rage against the machine, as it were. Instead of answering opposition with fists, we answer with open arms and I don't agree, but you're still a person and I still value your life. Maybe that's how we change hearts and minds.
I think that's one way to do it. And that might be uncomfortable for some people.
Obviously. Certainly. And I don't discount their discomfort, their discomfort at all.
What I think is important maybe is to approach it in a way where you can find some sort of shared interest.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like a Nazi, I don't have much in common with your viewpoint in life.
No.
But maybe we could talk about, like, you know, Glenn Danzig or what's your favorite bird? I don't know. Just like finding something that connects you to that person so that you could see each other's like shared humanity or interests. I think that will pull down the curtain a lot, like a lot quicker, because that's what I learned. Like when we were all pent up during the pandemic and I was watching the news incessantly and Trump was like, you know, the flames are, he was just stoking the fire. And every day I'm like, oh my God. And like, I was doing like a telehealth therapy, like yelling at this therapist, like, what the hell is going on? Like, just freaking out every day, getting in arguments with people that, that were at different viewpoints with me on the phone and arguing. And then like, and then now I'm out and about and meeting people of all their, and like, and I'm realizing, wow, that's, if you're isolated from people and you don't feel, if you don't think there's any kind of shared interest between you, you're wrong. There's always something there. Yeah. And if you can find that, I think that's probably a one way to break down that. And you might have less hate in your heart, because it's not good for us to sit there and have hate in our heart for everybody too, because they have a completely different viewpoint, a very backward, albeit backward viewpoint that I think is horrible and harmful. But I'm not going to sit there and go like, you know, I'm not gonna crumble from the inside because of that too. I think it's important to not ignore it and to not treat everybody like they're hate them. Don't hate. Just don't hate.
Because they think the same thing about our belief systems. Like, oh, they think it's okay to, you know, have abortions and for, you know, they think that we're as amoral as we think they are. Okay. Do I obviously think that we are more on the side of, you know, the right side of history? Of course. I feel that way. In the same token, I still think their lives have value. I don't think that, oh, you're a bigot, so you deserve to die. I don't fucking think that way. That's not who I am. I wasn't raised that way.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good way for anybody to think.
But a lot of people do on our side of the fence, and that disturbs me. That disturbs me personally, because
that's like what Enemy Mine is kind of about. Like,
what a wonderful fucking movie.
It's pretty much, you could take it either side. It's just people that, like, you know, they have to have this external like villain, you know, and people are kind of sold these ideas too. They don't just come out of a vacuum, you know. I mean, the way we fight with each other is it's very kind of organized from other people, you know. Like, I mean, we're kind of sold these sides to take to fight each other on a lot of times, and it's not really at the core of who people are most times. They just kind of grab onto these things because they feel like it's, you know, important to them, but it's not something they, you know, had their whole life necessarily, some of them. But some of them,
let's remember our audience, though, gentlemen, very quickly. Enemy Mine was a film that Dennis Quaid was an astronaut.
We're talking about our song, but I remember that movie.
Yeah. But the film, Louis Gossett Jr. is an alien called, what were they called, the Drax or something of that ilk, and Dennis Quaid's a white human astronaut, ends up on this planet. They end up on a planet together, and mortal enemies. Long story short, they find a reciprocity, and Louis Gossett Jr.'s alien character dies. Dennis Quaid's character ends up raising the child of this asexual creature's loins. Beautiful science fiction film. Very, very telling.
Oh, kid. Yeah, absolutely.
Of where we somehow end up in this reality now. But, you know, you can learn a lot from fiction or from a song or from, you know, the lessons being passed down from someone else with a radically dissimilar viewpoint. And I think that's kind of like the prescient point of what we're talking about. Art can and should serve as an ideal almost of where we should be headed. And I think through that, you guys are very much serving up an incredible example in that regard.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, we can't solve all the world's problems, all of us go through art, but we try our best. But yeah, I do agree with you, though. I think, like, we have to get away from this mindset of, like, this, you got to hate the person that has the backward thinking and do everything you can to stamp them down and destroy them. You can't think that way. All you're doing is throwing the same amount of hatred into the world that they are. You gotta talk to people. You have to talk to people.
And you can hug a white nationalist, but make sure nobody takes pictures.
Yeah. because you don't want to be completely
they'll put that all over the internet.
Yeah, look at them. They're from Pongos is a white nationalist. He's hugging us.
Yeah, I'm just hugging. It's just hugging.
Yeah, that's a big. Actually, that brings up an interesting thing. Context where how news will take a, or like people when they want to get a point across or they want you to hate something, they'll take the whole context away and they'll just show you a snippet and they'll go, did you hear what he said? Did you see what he did? And they don't know what happened to get to that point. We got to stop doing that crap too. That's like as bad as like the AI thing where we're making like people that didn't say anything say something that they didn't say because like you're taking the words they put into their mouths and animating their faces to
say. I think AI has actually provided a great excuse for people that have problems putting their foot in their mouths, because now politicians can always be like, hey, that was AI. It wasn't me.
Yeah, that's true.
Trump will be using that pretty soon when he's our fucking president again, because Biden lost. Sadly, I hate to say it, but with this Palestine thing, I think Biden fucked himself.
I think it was even before that. I think it's the age thing is what really, really.
When he basically called for no oversight to give billions of dollars to Israel to completely decimate and ethnically cleanse Palestine on behalf of Israel. He took everyone with a heart who was behind him. And like myself, I voted for Biden. I was very much I voted for Biden because he wasn't Trump, not because I liked Biden. Cause he's too goddamn old to run this fucking country. And he's shot, and I'm sad to say it, but I still think, like, ladies and gentlemen, I still think you should vote for Biden instead of Trump in this next election, no matter what the fuck this guy does.
I wonder what, I wonder if we'll have a surprise and, there'll be somebody else running, or I think Biden's well aware of this conundrum. And I think I don't think he wants his legacy to be to lose to Trump. The last thing he does, like, I think he wants to go out saying, like, I did this for the American people. I did all these things, tried to do this, and then go off into the sunset. I know he has things he doesn't want. He wants to finish. He wants to do right. Man, you know, like, give it to somebody else. And I don't know. I'm just hoping there's like something that happens with that. But I still don't think if it's Biden against Trump, I don't think Trump can win. Trump is so unhinged, man. Like, there's not that many people that I know that are, or that I even see that are behind him that much anymore. I mean, even the Republicans right now in Congress that, like, what was it, Chip Roy, who is like a classic MAGA guy today, was like, we are doing nothing. Like, we are completely screwing ourselves. And like, Trump didn't do anything. And you guys, and they're just, all you're doing is like, you're going in there and you're just blocking. And you're like, it's just, when a guy like that, who's super MAGA, is saying stuff like that, it's over, man. Like, no one's.
I hope you're right, because living in Northeastern Pennsylvania and driving to work every morning.
Sure.
I see Trump everything everywhere.
I know you see it still. You see it everywhere you go.
And it terrifies me, because like, living in semi-rural Pennsylvania, this is like, and we used to be a very democratic state.
Oh, right? I know. Yeah.
And we're slowly but surely becoming this psychotic hillbilly red state, and it's not the way I was raised, and it's not the people I was raised around, but somehow the people I was raised around are now that.
It's the fear that's being fear into their veins through the television that they watch.
Yeah.
They just look at it and they go, this is what's happening in the world. They look at it at like every city. Ask someone that lives in a city. Ask someone that lives in Philadelphia. I do. I'm like, oh, I heard about all this stuff that's happening in Philadelphia. Is this really happening?
No.
The way it's always been in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You're believing, or you're hearing something that's not happening. So I think those people are doing that. I still think it's a minority of people that would actually go to the polls and vote, because we have seen, on the same token, wonderful things happen, like in Ohio, with the abortion thing being put into their constitution, and like,
thank God
that's happening in a lot of places where you would think that wouldn't happen. So people are voting and saying like, oh, they don't want to lose their freedom. Look, Trump basically said recently, if I get back in office, I am going to imprison everybody that was against me. I'm going to open fire on protests and with American soldiers. I heard this. Did you hear this recently?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, oh, yeah.
Them, kill them if they protest. Nobody, even the people with the signs up there in Scranton, are going to vote for that. People aren't going to vote for that unless you're a complete maniac. And I don't think there's that many maniacs.
There's a few, but there's not that many.
No, I think anybody viable that came up, like, I'm surprised at all these guys that are trying to like a Nikki Haley or something. You know what I mean? I don't want to see any of them in, but like, I'd rather see her than Trump. I at least know she wouldn't bring us down she wouldn't destroy democracy. All the moderate ones though are getting picked out. You got like Vivek Ramaswamy, who's a complete maniac, and like
or Kennedy's Robert Kennedy's kid. God. Holy fuck, that asshole! We
started with that guy.
That guy deserves. He deserves a sitcom.
I don't even know what he believes in, man.
He doesn't believe in anything. He's a fucking whack job.
Yeah, he's like what's his name? Rand Paul. Like,
yeah,
he just likes to go against everything that's decent for people.
Rand Paul was like his father in drag.
He's like a posh Ron Paul.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. I think at the end of the day, we're not going to get the best ideas from politicians.
No.
I think the best ideas come from artists.
It always has been that way. But now politics run the culture, which has to end soon. I think people are getting sick of it, though. You're noticing like people are checking out with it, you know.
Clinton had two very wonderful, very viable, with the exception of NAFTA, which kind of fucked up a lot of organized labor, but he had 8 years of a very fruitful political career because of the fact that the 90s had Nirvana and grunge and punk and things like the world started to really change again during the time period where he was, you know, first coming into office when Bush part one left office. Revolution was in the air. Revolution's in the air again. And
like it has been for at least the last 3 years.
And I think now if Bernie would never run again, but now is the time when Bernie could win, my opinion.
How old's Bernie?
Fucking old. Just on, like man. The rest of them.
There's got to be. I mean, what about Pete Buttigieg? I love him, man. I think he should go.
I love Pete Buttigieg. The best thing is he's a veteran with a conscience. He's the kind of guy who would not get us involved in war.
And he goes on Fox. He talks to people that are different than him.
Yeah. Yeah, he reaches across the aisle in a meaningful way, not to pander, not to condescend, just to be available.
He's good at deflecting stuff that comes his way from the opposing side too.
Yeah,
in a reasonable way. He's a smart guy. I mean, we just need someone like that. Like that's the thing. Like Biden's done a lot of great stuff. I agree with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is painful sometimes when he's talking. It just takes a long time. He's very tired, which he should be. He works hard. Like, I get it.
Old man. He's been through enough.
I just want someone like clear as a bell talking. And like, I want a Barack Obama back who's on the TV. He's like, hello, everybody. You know, like a clear, I don't know. I'm just so tired of politics.
Well, politics. Politics are the afterthought to the culture that births it, right?
Yeah.
So I think the most prescient and important thing we can do as artists and, you know, former artist turned journalist can do is champion ideas. And I think you guys are doing that. And I think as long as you provide a soundtrack the way Nirvana and you know, the Minutemen and Husker Du did to, you know, their eras, you're doing your part and you're doing it with aplomb. And that's all we can fucking do, brother. That's all we can do.
And yeah, I mean, that's all I think I could do. I don't think we could change anything other than just put ideas out there and you know, put music out into the world is way, for me, way better than preaching to people about stuff. I don't know how to do, you know what I mean? It's easier to do that than talk about that stuff to me.
I mean, Joe Strummer said the personal is the political, and I agree with that in a sense, but the most important thing you can do is create the soundtrack to the revolution and just be that appropriate soundtrack, and that revolution, I promise you, will occur.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good to me.
With that being said, I think that is the perfect way to end this. But guys, we've been together before. We'll be together again. But promise me, the next time anything happens, you'll come to me again and we'll do this again.
Oh, anytime, my friend. It's always great to talk to you. Yeah, it's awesome. Thank you. And then hopefully we'll meet in person one of these times when we're traveling.
That would be beautiful. Just get in touch with me. You know how to find me.
I will, my friend.
All right. I love you guys so much.
Yeah. Thanks so much, man. I'll talk to you soon.
See you again. See you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.